Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and even if the presidential campaigns and most of the media are deciding to focus only on scandal, the Brian Lehrer Show will continue to talk about the issues as well. And let me be clear, the day-to-day campaign developments matter. We are discussing it on this show, as we did in our last segment. What I hope makes us different is that we also continue to take deep dives all the time on the real issues that affect Americans' lives directly. That's why we instituted our 30 Issues in 30 Weeks series to begin with, to ensure a safe space in which we will not get distracted by campaign headlines, no matter what they are. We've been doing that for at least two segments a week on each issue since the spring. We did four last week on immigration, which was issue 26. And now we continue with our 30 Issues election series, issue 27, what was supposed to be a central issue in the campaign, which candidates could be spending much more time debating: free trade is bad, or is it good, for American workers. Let's listen to some history. The first protectionist law that most of us learn about in school was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930. Now, we don't have archive tape going back that far, but we do have the 1986 movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, anyone, the Great Depression, passed the, anyone, a tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which, anyone, raised tariffs in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government. Did it work? Anyone? Anyone know the effects?
Mr. Bueller, I don't expect you to have the answer. Oh, but look who has his hand up. Yes, Mr. Gore?
In 1930, when the proposal by Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley was to raise tariffs across the board to protect our workers, and I brought some pictures, too.
President,
you brought some
Ross
pictures?
Is a protectionist?
This is a picture of Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley. They look like pretty good fellas. They sounded reasonable at the time. A lot of people believed them. The Congress passed the Smoot-Hawley protection bill. He wants to raise tariffs on Mexico. They raised tariffs, and it was one of the principal causes, many economists say the principal cause, of the Great Depression in this country and around the world.
Al Gore from his 1993 debate about NAFTA against Ross Perot. Smoot-Hawley imposed tariffs on imports as high as 60% in 1930. Now, tariffs had long been an issue in American politics. As we'll hear from a free trade historian who will join us in a few minutes, they pitted northern manufacturing states that wanted protection from low-cost imports against southern slave states that wanted low tariffs for its agricultural exports. More on that later. But back to the 20th century. Here is a 1938 clip of FDR's Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, who pioneered the modern free trade agreement. His home state of Tennessee stood to benefit, but he also framed the relaxation of Smoot-Hawley in the late 30s in the context of the rise of Nazism in Europe. Remember, this was 1938.
The task of rebuilding our foreign trade requires caution and infinite care. It is necessarily a slow process. In a world headed steadily in the direction of narrow nationalism, with all its attendant disasters for the well-being of our country and of all countries, we have taken a position of leadership in an effort to reverse that fatal trend. Our work has borne tangible fruit. But the stupendous task involved was only partly completed when a widespread war again broke out. That calamity has imposed upon us new tasks and new responsibilities. While hostilities are in progress, it is necessary for us to defend our export trade from the inroads of wartime controls and dislocations. For this purpose, the trade agreements now in effect are of inestimable value. The need for facilitating trade and for keeping alive the principles which underlie the trade agreement's program is of crucial importance.
a deep archive clip of Secretary of State Cordell Hull in 1938. World peace continued to be used as a rationale for free trade agreements under the theory that it would solidify the alliance among the free market nations of the world during the Cold War, and because countries that have mutually profitable trade relationships are less likely to go to war with each other. Here is President Lyndon Johnson in his 1968 State of the Union address referring to the so-called Kennedy round of trade negotiations that lowered tariffs between many non-communist countries.
Since I spoke to you last January, other events have occurred that have major consequences for world peace. The Kennedy Round achieved the greatest reduction in tariff barriers in all the history of trade negotiations.
President Johnson in 1968. Now let's get more to NAFTA. In 1993, the U.S. and Canada had recently sealed a trade agreement lowering tariffs just between the two countries, and Mexico wanted in. In that Gore-Perot debate that year, moderated by CNN's Larry King, after Clinton and Gore were elected, Perot, a businessman, described how he could exploit American workers more easily if NAFTA was passed.
When I'm in a room with corporate America, the first thing they say is, Perot, why don't you keep your mouth shut? You could, with your resources, make more money than anybody else. Here is the NAFTA game. Buy U.S. manufacturing companies cheap right after NAFTA passes. That are labor-intensive, that make good products, that have marginal profits. Close the factories in the U.S., move the factories to Mexico, take advantage of the cheap labor, run your profits through the roof, sell the company stock at a profit, go get another one.
That's what they do now. That's what they're doing right now.
That's what they're doing right now. Did you hear that? That was Al Gore's reply there. We hear the same argument today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership from President Obama, as Gore used there in 1993. Globalization is happening anyway. We might as well have a say in setting the rules. Now, the president of Mexico at the time, remember, was still in 1993, was Carlos de Salinas Gortari. As Perot and organized labor argued that NAFTA would kill jobs, Salinas argued in an MIT commencement address that it would create them. And you'll hear at the end of this clip, he throws in another sweetener for a U.S. audience. It would reduce Mexicans' desire to immigrate to the United States.
NAFTA is an environment improvement agreement because with additional resources, we will take better care of our environment. NAFTA is a wage-increasing agreement because we are committed to increasing real wages in Mexico more than they have increased up today when NAFTA is ratified. And NAFTA is a migration reduction agreement because Mexicans will not have to migrate north looking for jobs in this country, but they will be able to find them in my own, which is my own main commitment.
Mexican President Salinas in his 1993 MIT commencement address. NAFTA, of course, passed. Here's President Clinton at the signing ceremony addressing the fears of the opponents and promising to enforce labor and environmental protections.
When I affix my signature to the NAFTA legislation a few moments from now, I do so with this pledge to the men and women of our country who were afraid of these changes and found in their opposition to NAFTA an expression of that fear. What I thought was a wrong expression and what I know was a wrong expression, but nonetheless represented legitimate fears. The gains from this agreement will be your gains too. I ask those who oppose NAFTA to work with us to guarantee that the labor and side agreements are enforced. And I call on all of us who believed in NAFTA to join with me to urge the Congress to create the world's best worker training and retraining system. We owe it to the business community as well as to the working men and women of this country. It means greater productivity, lower unemployment, greater worker efficiency, and higher wages and greater security for our people. We have to do that.
After NAFTA, Clinton went on to negotiate more global free trade under the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that many nations participate in. The same skepticism about jobs, wages, and the environment persisted. A major demonstration grabbed world attention in Seattle in 1999 against the whole global free trade regime. So how would the Clinton administration sell it to the American people? Well, there was no WikiLeaks then to reveal the behind-the-scenes strategy talk, but I'd say the West Wing character, Toby Ziegler, pretty much nailed it.
You want the benefits of free trade? Food is cheaper.
Yes.
Food is cheaper. Clothes are cheaper. Steel is cheaper. Cars are cheaper. Phone service is cheaper. You feel me building rhythm here? That's because I'm a speechwriter. I know how to make a point.
Toby.
It lowers prices, it raises income. You see what I did with lowers and raises there?
Yes.
It's called the science of listener attention. We did repetition, we did floating opposites, and now you end with the one that's not like the others. Ready? Free trade stops wars. And that's it. Free trade stops wars. And we figure out a way to fix the rest. One world, one peace. I'm sure I've seen that on a sign somewhere.
Thank you, West Wing, circa 2001. One selling point for free trade agreements was that even if some jobs would flee and some wages would be depressed, Americans as consumers would have a lot more things to buy as imports at cheaper prices. Capitalizing on the increasing number of free trade imports, for example, was the nation's largest retailer, Walmart. Here's an example of a Walmart commercial from the year 2000.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face, brush off the clouds and cheer up.
Back prices because we know how much you like to save. Walmart, always low prices, always.
Walmart sales pitch in 2000, rolling back prices. At the same time as his administration was nearing its end, President Clinton argued for bringing China into the World Trade Organization. A key concern at that time that we really don't hear at all today wasn't that China would be a massive low-wage competitor to the United States, but that China was a human rights violator in its own country and therefore should be ostracized from the world economy. President Clinton addressed this in arguing for China's inclusion in the WTO in 2000.
It does deny its citizens fundamental rights of free speech and religious expression. It does define its interests in the world and sometimes in ways that are dramatically at odds from our own. But the question is not whether we approve or disapprove of China's practices. The question is, what's the smartest thing to do to improve these practices? I believe the choice between economic rights and human rights, between economic security and national security, is a false one. You know, as we debate about China here, and we love to do it, it absorbs a great deal of our time and energy. It's easy to forget that the Chinese leaders and their people are also engaged in a debate about us there. And many of them believe that we honestly don't want their country to assume a respected place in the world. If China joins the WTO, but we turn our backs on them, it will confirm their fears.
Bill Clinton in 2000. Hillary Clinton's issues with China today are so different, as in when she explained her decision to no longer support the TPP on the PBS NewsHour last October.
I'm worried about currency manipulation not being part of the agreement. We've lost American jobs to the manipulations that countries, particularly in Asia, have engaged in. I'm worried that the pharmaceutical companies may have gotten more benefits and patients and consumers fewer. I think that there are still a lot of unanswered questions. What I know about it as of today, I am not in favor of what I have learned about it. So for the larger issues and then what I know, and again, I don't have the text, we don't yet have all the details, I don't believe it's going to meet the high bar I have set.
So the debate continues between Clinton and Trump when they're not obsessing on each other's alleged scandals. He is still knocking NAFTA, and she is still defending it as the opening, as in the opening moments of their first debate.
We approved
NAFTA,
which is the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country.
Incomes went up for everybody. Manufacturing jobs went up also in the 1990s, if we're actually going to look at the facts.
And that's our brief audio history of free trade politics in our 30 Issues Election Series, Issue 27. Free trade is bad, or is it good, for American workers. Let's talk about this history with I.M. Dessler, public policy professor at the University of Maryland and author of books including American Trade Politics. Professor Dessler, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
You wrote a piece this spring in the Harvard Business Review tracing the free trade debate back to the slavery era. Can you talk about the relevance to that?
Well, it was related to slavery, but I think the South, as the central cotton producer in the country, which was a major U.S. export in the 19th century, would have been for free trade in any case, slave or free. But you did have a division between the beginnings of manufacturing in the north of the country where people wanted to protect the industries and the cotton, which was highly competitive and felt that the open trade policy would lead to more exports. And in different ways, this division continued into the 20th century, and it meant that for a good while, Democrats were the supporters of free trade, and Republicans who represented the industrial constituency were against it. Now, that has changed more recently.
Listeners, if you want to ask a question or say something about the history of free trade in the United States or protectionism, 212-433-WNYC, if you have a history or an analysis question. Professor Dessler is here for that, or say what you want, 212-433-9692, here in our 30-issue series, issue 27. Smoot-Hawley in 1930, was it a response to the stock market crash of 1929?
It was not entirely that, although people represented it as that. It sort of began as a feeling that they needed to protect agriculture a little more, which was in Great Depression at that time. And then it sort of mushroomed because a lot of industries wanted protection. Congress was willing to provide it. And if you provide it to one industry, you provide it to another. So it all sort of got bigger and bigger until in the end, the average tariff on products where we charge duties was 60%, which is incredible. Now it's well under 5%. And the result was not to improve the U.S. economy, to make it worse. The Great Depression was already beginning, but Smoot-Hawley, by universal analysis, I think, made it worse.
Tariffs today are under 5%, so all this to do about TPP and other trade agreements is just to take off a couple of points of a tariff?
Essentially, that's right. I mean, most of the tariff reduction has already occurred through a series succession of agreements, including the Kennedy round that President Johnson was talking about, including a round completed under President Clinton, the so-called Uruguay round. And so, yeah, tariffs are actually quite low. Now, there are other barriers to trade, other trade restraints that TPP and earlier agreements try to deal with. So it's not just a matter of tariffs, but basically, the economic impact of TPP is grossly exaggerated by its opponents and to some degree by its proponents as well. It is not going to make that much difference for the U.S. economy.
So why are the two sides so dug in?
That's a very good question. They're developed after NAFTA, after the critics of NAFTA, organized labor, some environmental groups, some human rights groups, lost the battle of NAFTA. They continue to mobilize. They continue to be active. Your video mentioned the big demonstration in Seattle, which essentially closed down the town and closed down a World Trade Organization conference then and slowed up movement toward further trade negotiations. And so you had this emerging opposition, and there has been, over time, there has been a lot of job displacement in particular parts of the United States. Some of it is caused by trade. Some of it is caused by technology. Moreover, although President Clinton talked in the clip you said about a creating the best job trade retraining program in the world. The United States has not done that. We have something called trade adjustment assistance, which helps some workers displaced by trade, but not all that many. And generally speaking, particularly under conservative control of the Congress, programs that spend money have not gotten very much interest. And to do a really good job of comprehensive job retraining would be billions of dollars, maybe $10 billion or more a year, whereas we're spending one or two right now.
Huh. So when Obama sells TPP as the gold standard of trade agreements because of better labor environmental standards and better enforcement of those, and Clinton used to agree until she disagreed, do the facts bear him out? Have you read the 30 chapters of the 11-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership?
I've read a good bit of it. I can't say I've read every word. I've read summaries, and I've read, and the it does definitely have stronger labor and environmental standards than any other trade agreement we have put forward. And it, because the United States is less protected than at least some of the countries in terms of its own market, this means the United States, relatively speaking, is a winner in that people talk about leveling the playing field. Trade people like to talk about that. And this does level the playing field to a significant degree, making other countries relatively more open, making us more open too. But since we're, as you pointed out, very, very open already, the balance of benefits is for us. The problem is, for selling it, is the bottom line is not huge. It's maybe 1 or 2% of GDP total. And that's nice over spread over a long period of time, but people won't really notice it.
Do you think NAFTA has been a net plus for United States workers, or would you have to separate that out into big baskets of winners and losers?
You would have to separate it out. Now, what Hillary Clinton said was absolutely correct, that in the years after NAFTA, U.S. employment went up enormously through the Clinton administration. Some of that was manufacturing employment. Most of it was not. And there were certainly those who were vulnerable in the sense of relatively low wages, and industries that were labor intensive tended to lose. Those that were more high tech, that were more advanced processes and so forth, tended to be winners. And so it's a matter of this distribution of benefits, and you see this more generally in the United States, and it's reflected in the presidential campaign. Large parts of the country have been beneficiaries of globalization, particularly along the East and West coasts, and they're in contrast to a number of areas, particularly toward the center of the country or the Midwest, who have been on balance sufferers. But again, there are a lot of exceptions within those. I mean, in Ohio, you have a lot of job loss from over the years, over the decades, from trade and from even more probably from technology change. But you have also communities that have moved ahead in services, moved ahead in ways that have they've gotten beyond this. And the notion that Trump suggests that you can bring these manufacturers' jobs back is totally impossible. I mean, it's just like, it's not the only thing he has suggested that's totally impossible, but that certainly is.
My guest is University of Maryland public policy professor I.M. Dessler, who has written, among other books, American Trade Politics. As we continue with our 30 Issues election series, issue 27 this week, free trade is bad, or is it good for American workers? And we'll go to the phones in just a minute, but I just want to answer a question that came in from a listener on Twitter, and you can follow us at Brian Lehrer. But somebody said, wait, those Perot versus Gore clips you played, was Gore, as the vice presidential candidate, actually debating the third-party independent presidential candidate, Ross Perot? And the answer is, as I actually mentioned in the essay, President Clinton and Vice President Gore had already been elected, and Gore and Clinton were trying to get NAFTA through Congress, and Gore agreed to go on television and debate the failed third-party presidential candidate, Ross Perot, which, looking back on it, is really, really remarkable that that ever happened, isn't it?
It is, and, well, Perot had written this book, which suggested again, wildly exaggerating that millions and millions of jobs were at risk under NAFTA. And he was a vocal critic of it, and a highly visible critic of NAFTA. He'd been so during the election campaign as well. And so he was a good target, and Gore thought correctly that he could beat him in a debate. Now, some people thought that it was a risk because by that point, support for NAFTA was coalescing. The administration was probably going to win anyway. But the Gore victory over Perot, and it was universally regarded, regardless of people's views on the subject, that Gore had won the debate. That kind of clinched the case, and NAFTA won congressional approval by a larger margin than anybody had expected.
Linda, on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Hi. My concern is something that doesn't seem to be getting much publicity, and that's the investor dispute resolution process, where a tripartite panel of corporate attorneys on leave from their jobs will have total decision-making powers with no appeal through the U.S. court system. And foreign companies can sue for loss of projected income, and it's already been invoked under other trade agreements for things like the vetoing of the Keystone Pipeline, and we've had to change some of our laws to avoid paying fines for, I think we had to pay a fine for the banning of, MTBE in gasoline, and we've overturned laws that for country of origin labeling of meat, all because we would have had to pay huge fines. And I'm wondering why the loss of the sovereignty in this country has not gotten more publicity in the talks.
Professor, do you agree with her characterization of what that investor dispute resolution system would produce?
Briefly on the investor state resolution. This has been in many trade agreements. The number of cases where the U.S. Interests have lost out, or people have really been very small. Many of these cases get thrown out. It's been a favorite subject for critics of the agreement, but the actual case is pretty thin in terms of, if you look at all of the possible disputes, all of the possible investments around the world. Now, in terms of loss of sovereignty, there is something here. I mean, the whole notion that we would agree to lower our tariffs and bind our tariffs at a lower level so that we are essentially breaking our international commitments if we raise them, that is a limitation of sovereignty. The whole point, the way that trade agreements work, is we agree to limit ourselves and other countries agree to limit them, and we get mutual benefit.
So for example, if a country is putting a lot of state subsidy into an industry that competes with American products in the same industry that is not getting government subsidies, then they would agree in many cases to give that up, in effect giving up a little bit of their sovereignty to get whatever benefits they get from the agreement.
And similarly with labor and environmental commitments, which are mainly things that we already do, the protections we already provide, and so others are giving. So it is a mutual, a lot of international agreements involve limitations of sovereignty, but we're in a global world.
But then what you just said kind of reinforces the caller's point that at least in theory, we could enact a really good environmental protection law that then gets thrown out in an international court under a free trade agreement, right?
It could happen. It could happen. It hasn't happened very often. And there are serious people who are looking at ways of addressing that. But it's a question of how if you make commitments that do tie your hands on certain issues, mainly on economic issues. And there are provisions in TPP involving internet freedom, free use of the internet. Now, our country, we have free use of the internet. Other countries tend to restrict it sometimes for political purposes. Mm-hmm. Now, they are then losing some sovereignty over that in the agreement. I think that's good. I think that's in our interest. It's probably in their interest, and at least and also in terms of our promoting open societies, open communication. But again, you know, it is a constraint that people accept. Now, if you believe that your country should never enter agreements that tie its hands in any way, then you're basically saying we should isolate ourselves, because that's what international agreements do. They do tie your hands.
Mark in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Yes, I would like to make a commentary regarding the way free trade is done in the old days as compared to NAFTA. In the old days, from what I can recall, the American investors would, you know, for example, build a factory in a third world country. They would own the factory. They would monopolize the know-how, you know, the production processes, et cetera. The top level management of that factory would be staffed mainly by Americans, and the lower level, you know, by the nationals. Now, what I've noticed is that the production process and the know-how are outsourced to the Chinese. You know, the Chinese own the production processes. They own the factories. So, you know, that gives them a lot of power. They then, in turn, you know, export the products back to the United States to what I would call distribution companies like Under Armour or Apple. The Chinese then would not only export the stuff to here, but in other markets as well, like in other third world countries, in other developing countries, because they dominate there compared to America. In the old days, when a lot of people wanted to import stuff in other countries, you know, they would simply come to the United States and, you know, put in their orders, etc. But now,
Mark, are you saying that it was better when the U.S. owned more of the local companies in whatever markets, and the local people in those countries work for them? Now there are more local subcontractors, like Chinese-owned subcontractors with Apple, and that's worse for the workers? Is that the point you're making?
I think so, because what I have noticed, like the Chinese, if you go to parts of Africa, I mean, they're creating environmental havoc there. A lot of corruption is going on. But they extract far more out of the poorer countries than what they would get, like, from the wealthier countries.
Yes, and I'm going to leave it there. Professor, any comment on that?
Okay, well, TPP does not currently include China, so that's not directly. Right? But you have to look at the broader picture. Upwards of 500 million people have come out of poverty in the world in the last 20 years. Trade has been a part of that, not the whole thing. But a lot of those are Chinese, a lot of them a lesser number, but it's an example number of people from India. But the movement, the globalization of the great economy has been a major benefit to many human beings. And so I think one of the ironies is people on the left say they're against trade, but they say they're in favor of, you know, of welfare for everybody. I mean, a good life for everybody. Well, trade has been one of the engines of that good life. And it is too bad that I think the way our politics has moved, that the Democratic Party has become very trade skeptical, because in the large global picture, there have been enormous benefits for hundreds of millions of human beings.
But does that support then, based on that argument, take a certain kind of liberal thinking, which says, well, the United States is so affluent, we can give up a little bit of our wage advantage in the world so that millions of Chinese can move out of poverty?
Well, I think some people might say that, but you don't have to say we're giving up. It is a question of certain products that we don't have. We are not as competitive in a world market because we may have higher wages and so forth. And so there is the whole notion that if we are a high cost producer, then under trade we lose out to countries that are relatively low cost producers. But because productivity in the United States is so much higher per worker than in other countries, we are still competitive in a large number of areas, and the workers get much higher pay in the United States.
So last thing, explain one of the things that President Obama says constantly about this 11-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that is he emphasizes what you just said a minute ago, that it does not include China, and that this helps the United States set the rules of the global economy and weakens China's ability to do that. What rules?
Well, the rules of the global economy are substantially rules embedded in international trade agreements, but it's also an emerging set of rules on broader issues. I mentioned internet freedom as one example. Labor and environment is another that are covered in the TPP.
But if China's not in it, forgive me for interrupting, but we're running out of time. If China's not in it, and China is so huge, how does it change the game in terms of benefiting American workers?
Well, it benefits the United States and other countries who are in the agreement because they gained trade benefits, and the Chinese then are hopefully over time motivated to change their approach in ways that would make their economy less restrictive, more open, that would be the impact. So if we, on the other hand, if we back away, we're losing economic leadership in the area, and the Chinese norms are more likely to prevail, and other countries are going to have to make their deals with China because of its size and power.
By the way, you mentioned the Democratic Party moving away from trade. How do you see the Republicans? Because the Democrats have been the skeptics for a long, long time. Now we have the Trump movement, which is conservative anti-free traders. Do you see it as different?
It is certainly very different for a Republican presidential candidate. And Trump is more anti-trade, more scathing about it than any presidential candidate I can think of ever.
But is it different substantively, motivated by something different than liberal skepticism?
I don't. It's hard to know. It's not fundamentally different, except that it's much more sweeping, much more broad brush. It's interesting. If you look at public opinion polls, increasingly, Democrats across the country are for trade and Republicans are skeptical. It's very interesting because the Congress is the House of Representatives splits the opposite way. But the actual public opinion has moved increasingly. Democrats are positive about trade and Republicans are more skeptical.
I think it's economics for the Democrats and nationalism for the new Trump conservatives.
There's nationalism for Republicans more generally, but the Trump conservatives are an extreme version of that.
Indeed. Public policy professor at the University of Maryland, I.M. Dessler. He's the author of books including American Trade Politics. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure and very interesting to listen to your questioners as well.
And we will continue to cover the ugly horse race until Election Day, but we will also continue our 30 Issues election series next week, Issue 28. Here on The Brian Lehrer Show, whose voting rights are being challenged this year?